Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me once again is John Lindemann.
What's up, party people?
Glad to have you back, John. I'm sure you are very grateful to have power and internet.
Good to be back. I've survived hurricanes and earthquakes, literally. That's how much this show means to me, Johnny.
All right. James is not here right now, but he'll be coming in a little bit later in this segment. He had some car trouble, but fear not, he will be here. Who we don't have is Greg Leahy, who almost never misses an episode, but we're recording on a different night this week due to a certain football game and maybe other things as well. But so Greg is not here tonight, but I think you'll find that we found a worthy substitute in returning champion, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chris Kohler.
Thank you. Thank you.
Such a muted response.
No, please. You're too kind. No. Sit down. It's okay.
Chris, it's really good to have you back on. It's been almost 2 years, I think, since you were on the show.
It has been a while, and it's not because I don't want to be on the show. It's because you record on Thursdays, and I have a standing obligation on Thursdays.
I understand.
No, I just want the people to understand.
It's always surprising, yes. Though. I mean, we see you at PAX, and we see you here and there, so it's never... It's surprising to me that you haven't been on our event for 2 years.
You know I'm still alive, basically, as you see me from time to time. It's like, oh, there he is. Huh, hasn't died yet.
I'm sure most of our listeners know Chris from Wired.com's Game Life gaming blog. And I don't know if you are going to be in the future, but you have been for years a very frequent contributor to the Retronauts podcast, which we're big fans of.
Yeah, they haven't fired me off of that yet, as far as I know.
Okay. Well, now that IGN has sort of taken over it, I don't know what the new format is. It's been kind of weird, like back and forth between like studio recorded versions and live call-in shows. So.
Right. I know IGN had probably had a few changes that they wanted to pass over to 1UP, and I'm pretty sure that Get Rid of That Kohler guy wasn't on the list.
Oh, good.
So fingers crossed I should be returning at some point.
Yeah, certainly hope so. So later in the show, we are going to be getting to a discussion of some of this crazy Japanese news that you've heard about. Well, some of it's not Japanese news, it's just news out of Japan that affects everyone, probably. But we're going to hold off on that for now and do a little bit of new business. And since John was out last week, I thought I would ask him to go first.
Well, my new business, it was definitely affected by my power being out for a good 3 days, my internet being out for 6 days, I think. Actually, I did get a little bit of Dark Void Zero in, which actually it was actually good. I actually got more time in previously than I did my old buy a game, play it for an hour, and then walk away from it for X number of months/years. But fortunately, I was able to actually go back to Dark Void Zero thanks to a hurricane.
Well, it is an awesome game.
Yeah, it is an awesome game, and actually it was. I'm really glad I actually went back to it because it gets better, you know, the further you go into it. I mean, it is really, it's quality all the way through. And I actually got to, you know, get a bit deeper into it. And so that was really, really good. There's four areas in it, right, Johnny?
That sounds correct, yeah.
So I got about halfway through it. I didn't get all the way to the second boss, but...
Yeah, the stages are actually really big.
Yeah. I also, my PSP, which usually sits around gathering dust, got some playtime. And I was playing Resistance Retribution, which I had kind of touched on way, way back because, again, my PSP pretty much sits around gathering dust, and I hadn't really gotten too much further into it, but I had time. There's really not much to do when, you know, your power's out, right? So,
Except read a book.
Yeah, God forbid. Well, the thing is, you can't even do that at night because, I mean, unless you're going to read it by candlelight,
right?
You know, it gets kind of silly. But yeah, I mean, not really too much more to say. I mean, I feel like Greg would really appreciate the portrayal of the Brits in that game. There's a lot of like stiff upper lip, a lot of British slang being thrown around, and it's just completely ridiculous. But you know, I mean, it's a classic case, much like Monster Hunter, a classic case of a game that they just try to shoehorn way too many things onto the PSP control scheme.
Yeah. Oh boy, we're going to come back to that topic a little bit later, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, and this the biggest problem is with the camera control. I mean, it's a third-person shooter, and even though they do give you they do help you with aiming, there's just so many times when when monsters attack you quickly, or like, you know, when several monsters attack you at once and you're pretty much just cannon fodder strictly because of the fact that you cannot control the camera quickly enough. And like there's a couple of times where I just wanted to toss my PSP across the room because it's just so cheap. You don't have a chance. You know, I mean, you're pretty much just like walking along the same path through the whole thing, right? It's pretty scripted. Actually, I mean, it is pretty much scripted because you walk along past a certain point, two or three enemies come out, you shoot them, move along. You know, you kind of like trial and error your way to the end.
That's a real shame. I mean, it seems like rather than give you bad camera control, the game could have been designed around the fact that the controls are limited.
Yeah.
And use some kind of AI-controlled camera or basically a mostly fixed camera angle so that you wouldn't have to deal with that stuff and you could just concentrate on the action.
Yeah, I don't really know what else they would do with it. I mean, it's a corridor shooter, but it's not...
It's not like on rails.
Exactly. It's not an on-rail shooter. So,
do you think it's just a type of game that's poorly fit for this system?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, they wanted to put that type of game on the PSP, but it's really kind of a curious thing. I mean, I'm not really too sure why Sony didn't put two analog sticks on that thing to begin with.
They're Japanese. They're Japanese, and it was 2004.
Yeah.
Right. Or 2003, probably, when they were, like, you know, finalizing the design of the PSP. There was absolutely no sense of, like, well, why would we put two sticks on this thing? You know, this is a Japanese system for Japanese video games, and it doesn't actually matter if you can run a first-person shooter on it or not. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Now, of course, with the PlayStation Vita, I think they have seen the writing on the wall. They need to sell this thing in the West. They need Western designers to make games for it, and that's, you know, the Western games have been the biggest sellers by far for the PlayStation 3.
Mm-hmm.
It's really strange to me, though, because, you know, when you talk about the big Western games for PS3, for instance, you don't need two sticks for Uncharted. You don't need them for God of War. You don't need them for Wipeout. So I find it really strange. I mean, we brought this up a couple of weeks ago when some of the rumors were hitting and people were asking about the proposed or the rumored second slide pad for 3DS. And I was saying, you know, I don't really think you need it. You certainly didn't need it in 2004, and I don't think you need it today. I don't think the Vita needs a second joystick. I mean, it doesn't hurt anything to have it on there, so I'm not bothered by it, of course. But I think the calls from fans that the system absolutely has to have a second joystick is really overblown, because who wants to play a first-person shooter on a handheld?
I don't know about that.
I don't think that market actually exists.
That's a very good observation. That's a billion-dollar question, right? I mean, you know, that's kind of what they're going for with Vita, is this idea that, you know, you're going to play these, you know, massive kind of big-budget games on your Sony handheld system. And you're right, it is kind of an X factor. It's like, are they going to... If the Vita doesn't do it with two analog sticks built in, really high-powered graphics, and people making all kinds of first-person shooters for it, then, I mean, probably no one... Probably no one wants to play them, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you, Johnny, if, you know, Vita falls flat on its face and nobody cares about the first-person shooters on it. Because, to me, they've never really been given a fair shake on portables until now with Vita.
Right.
You know, in other words, they've never been given the chance to have parity, at least with the play experience versus console first-person shooters that they have on Vita. So.
Yeah, I don't think they're ever going to have parity, because the experience of playing on a handheld is different than playing on a console. And that's a kind of game... That, I mean, I'm kind of just picturing myself playing one of these games in my mind. Mm-hmm. I don't think I want to play Modern Warfare on the PS Vita. Some people might think they do, but I think once they actually try it, they realize that they'd probably rather play that on their couch or maybe at their PC. But playing a game like that on a small screen that's held in your hands and having to find some kind of, you know, position yourself in a comfortable way, so because it's a really intense game, and it's very, very detailed. You really have to pay attention to it. The other thing is the online play. I don't think is going to be very conducive to a handheld either, because, you know, you're always wondering, can I get online here? Can I not get online here? And it's all muddled by the fact that the Vita has this 3G connection that's optional that will not let you play Modern Warfare online. There's no way that they're going to do that. So I think they're just going to confuse people a lot. And ultimately, these experiences obviously will be coming to Vita. I just think that people are going to play these and realize that it's not really all that they thought it would be. And that this is not really the kind of game that they want to play on a handheld.
Yeah, I mean, we'll just have to see. I mean, I won't be going to the Vita for, you know, some kind of all-encompassing online experience. I'm more going just to, you know, I'll be content with being able to play through a campaign mode on it. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very interesting what Chris said about the PSP, obviously, you know, being designed in Japan. All of the games outside of, you know, Monster Hunter that try to cram these control schemes onto the PSP are all made by Western devs.
Mm-hmm. And to be fair, let's also note that not to get too far ahead of ourselves, because you know we're going to talk about this later in the show, but this monstrosity of a second analog stick add-on that they're developing for the Nintendo 3DS seems to have been inspired directly by Monster Hunter, and so it's very possible that second stick on the Vita could have come about by Capcom going to Sony and saying, we need a second stick for Monster Hunter, do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you're not getting Monster Hunter, you know?
Yeah.
And that would have been enough for Sony, because it was clearly enough for Nintendo.
Yeah.
Okay, and I also stuck with the same franchise and still played some more of the beta.
For Resistance 3. Yeah.
So pretty much my experience with that kind of did a complete 180 from what I was playing before, because I was using the default guns that you have are the carbine and the bullseye. And so I was using those and I was really getting nowhere. I mean, I was getting just completely stomped, like to the point where like I was like, pretty much I hate this game. I would never buy it. There's no way, you know, I pretty much gave up on the game. And then I was like, well, you know, just as one last ditch effort, I figure I'll try one of the other guns. And so I switched over to the shotgun. And things completely changed, which tells me that either the other guns are underpowered or the shotgun is completely overpowered. Shotgun's probably overpowered, but what you can do is you can get like the Rossmore shotgun and you can upgrade it so that it has shells that explode and set your enemies on fire. So even if you don't kill them with your first shot outright and they kill you, they'll still be set on fire and die. So, I mean, after you get that, I mean, things changed totally. Like, I mean, at one point I had like a 10 kill streak going. It was crazy. So it'll be interesting to see how they kind of patch that out. I'm pretty sure eventually they'll probably nerf the Rossmore down. But yeah. So I mean, I still haven't picked it up. I didn't bother getting it day one. But
I've seen some pretty good reviews for it. It looks like the campaign is a big improvement over the second one.
Yeah, yeah. The second one was kind of all over the place. They were trying to. I felt they really strayed from kind of like what the first game in the series was. An alien sort of horror theme, like it was more creepier than anything else. And then the second game in the series was more just kind of like a Call of Duty clone sort of thing, where you know they brought in different kinds of classes and stuff like that. So I mean, definitely, it's I'll pick it up as soon as I can. I'm waiting for some sort of price drop down to $40 or something like that, but I'll definitely pick it up when I can.
Cool. Well, it's good to know that your opinion improved after you turned the corner on something. That happens to me all the time, actually. It happened to me a little bit on Ghost Trick, which I finished over the weekend and actually played a lot last week. I was at went to some concerts in Denver over the weekend, and I kind of got there like an hour early every night and kind of found where I wanted to sit. And so then I would just bust out the 3DS and just killed some time that way until the show started. And so I got to play through quite a bit of Ghost Trick that way. Mm-hmm. And when I played this game over the course of several weeks, kind of off and on, a little bit here, a little bit there. And it obviously got amazing reviews, and James and Greg both loved it. 2IP loved it, and I borrowed his copy. And I was playing it, and the first few hours, really, I felt the mechanics were so limited, and there was so much story that I didn't really care about, that I felt like the game, it's just, the pacing is, and this hasn't changed, but the pacing throughout the entire game is pretty stodgy. And there are times where I wish it would just flow better. You know, like you could move through this stuff faster. But I have to say, after about the halfway point in the game, the puzzles became more challenging and more interesting. They started to add a couple of new wrinkles to it that I wasn't expecting, including a pretty major new mechanic about 80% through the game. Maybe three quarters, maybe even a little bit more than that. And that was really interesting because it allows them to do some completely different kinds of puzzles than they could do before.
Do you think it was too late to introduce it, to use it properly?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think they use it as... I don't think there was that much more design they could have squeezed out of this new mechanic that they add. But I think it would have been good to have another mechanic that was introduced earlier in the game so that it was spread out more.
Yeah.
Because by the time you get to this... The standard, just moving your ghost line by line around the environment and just manipulating a couple of things, it's really become pretty old. Mm-hmm. And the Rube Goldberg type contraptions become, I feel like, more and more exasperating over time. Like, they just become more ridiculous and more difficult to understand how you would ever solve that kind of a thing. You know, so at some point it does feel like you just start to poke at everything and just try to manipulate everything until something works. And you end up doing a lot of retries when you're trying to save these people because you didn't find exactly the right combination. So, I mean, it was really kind of starting to stretch itself, and then it just sort of turns this corner. The mechanics got refreshed, and that helped a lot. some of the puzzles became a little more, I guess, outside the box in how you have to approach them. And the story, to my great surprise, really started to pull me in. And I think this is almost by design, because the way the story in Ghost Trick is set up is that you have this very long introduction. I mean, it's nearly half the game, where your character has amnesia, of course. It's Japanese. So your main character has amnesia, and he spends the entire game trying to figure out who he is and why he's become a ghost. And in the process, he meets dozens of other characters and visits dozens of places. And a lot of these are introduced very early in the game, and it's just like this shotgun. You know, they're just spraying you with new people and new places and new story elements and new subplots. And it, and a lot of what seem like random distractions that don't get you anywhere near the main goal of the game. I felt kind of exhausted by it. And the interesting thing is, about halfway through the game, some of the loops start to close. And not everything, certainly. I mean, the game still has major surprises all the way to the end. But some of the smaller relations between characters and explanations for why you went to some place earlier in the game that seemed pointless, a lot of that stuff starts to close up around halfway through, and I started to feel like it was really coming together, and I was kind of surprised by that, because I thought this was a real mess up to that point. And then it just kept going that way all the way to the end. And I felt like by the end, you know, it's not like classic literature or anything, but I think the way that the story is extremely complex and very confusing at times, but the way it's all woven together and the planning that must have gone into it to actually make it work out the way it does is kind of amazing, I think. And it was all set up from the very beginning, and there's no way you could know it until you get near the end, because there's just so many elements to it and it's so wacky. And I came away actually very, very impressed, and I sort of reached a turning point where I felt like I was starting to fall in love with this game. And I really didn't even know if I liked it in the first half, but it was just the way it all converged. I was so impressed by it, and the characters, the story, I'm not going to say it's emotionally moving or anything like that, but the characters' motivations are more interesting than I would have ever expected from the beginning. And it really did pull me in. I think it's actually very good storytelling. And I wasn't surprised when I finally saw the end credits that the game designer is the same person who wrote the story and directed the game. And I think it actually would have to be that way, because the way that you actually play the game, the way the puzzles are put together, is actually surprisingly integrated with the story itself, mm-hmm. in a way that you don't see very often. I mean, you know, for instance, in a Zelda game, you have all these dungeons with all these puzzles, and the puzzles are fun and they're part of the reason you play it, but they don't actually have anything to do with the story. They're just kind of these things that you do to kill some time or to open a door. And then you go in there, and then you have a scene where the story is told. And the interesting thing in Ghost Trick is that the puzzles that you solve are actually very much tied into the story. And some of the puzzles you do early in the game that seem like just these Rube Goldberg contraptions that they set up for you to deal with are so insane, and you think, why is this here? You know, like, why? And it turns out later on that there's actually a very good reason that it's there, and there's a very good reason that it's set up the way it is according to the story. I was really surprised by that, and I thought, this is incredible that the story writer and the game designer kind of got together and made all this fit together, and then, of course, it turns out it's the same person.
Yeah.
And it probably had to be for it to work out the way it did.
Would you say that you need to get to the end of the game, you know, that you should kind of persevere towards the end of the game in order to see all of that and how it all comes together?
No, I think you'll start to appreciate it a lot earlier than that.
Okay.
But it will take a few hours for sure. It's not apparent what the game is really trying to do right off the bat. It's so abstract in the beginning, and it's just so, the story is so confusing because you don't know anything, and that the information that the game provides to you just seems really scattershot and disconnected. And so it takes a few hours until all that stuff starts to pull together. But once it did, I found myself becoming more and more and more enamored with it and more addicted to it. And I think you reach a certain point where there's no way you're going to stop playing this. You reach a certain point where you absolutely have to see how this ends, and you will want to beat the game, because it's building up to some kind of unpredictable climax, and you have to see what that is. And there aren't many games, for me personally, there aren't many games that can actually become more interesting as they go on. So that was a very pleasant experience. And now I can move on to since there's still no 3DS games coming out that I want to play, now I can move on to trying to finish Dragon Quest VI, which I started way back before E3. I did beat Gargoyle's Quest, which was great.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's really hard. Really hard. Mm. And I actually, it's hard in a way that I felt a great sense of accomplishment for progressing in it and eventually beating it. I felt like I really did something good.
It is a Ghouls and Ghosts game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But compared to like Ghosts and Goblins or Super Ghouls and Ghosts, it's nothing compared to those.
Right.
But it's also a different kind of hard. You know, it's very different. It's more about really deft platforming rather than just hordes of monsters being thrown at you and like really evil enemy placement and stuff like that.
So it's a cheap kind of hard as opposed to a rewarding kind of hard that makes you stronger as a person.
Okay. And I'm not sure if Chris is aware of the running gags we have on Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
I love Super Ghouls and Ghosts. So does Greg.
I despise it.
Yeah.
But I do really like Gargoyle's Quest, and you know I've spoken before, and we've had people write in and ask me about my sort of interests in platforming design in terms of grappling hooks and jetpacks and you know skateboards and anything, any kind of mode of transportation in a platform game. I feel like it offers the designers a really interesting opportunity to design around that. And, you know, a lot of, if you take just a typical 2D platform and you add those elements in and you don't actually make good use of them, you're wasting your time. But the great thing about Dark Void Zero and Gargoyle's Quest is that these are games where they give you really interesting ways to move around the environment, but they also design the game around that to give you a lot of challenges that you could never overcome without those powers. And so even though you feel powerful, I mean, you have this hover in Gargoyle's Quest that lets you do some pretty crazy stuff in the air. And you can also cling to walls, you know, and these are really powerful platforming techniques. But because they give you these great abilities, they also demand very high levels of play out of you. And they make you use those abilities in some really cool, interesting ways that you haven't seen in other games, even though this one is 20 years old. And, you know, Demon's Crest does the same thing, and that's why I really love that game, and I would love a chance to play that again. Sometime soon. But Gargoyle's Quest is definitely a great starting point. And since Greg mentioned the NES sequel to this, now I'm really, really hoping that we get some kind of re-release of that. Because if it's even better than this one, I would absolutely love to play it.
Well, I'm sure they can just bring it out on Virtual Console. Sorry.
Have you played it, Chris?
Couldn't even get through that. I have played a little bit of Gargoyle's Quest. I've played like I don't know, maybe like a half an hour of it, found out that it was good and then put it down and haven't played it since. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one day I'll probably actually now that it's on 3DS, I might throw myself into it, especially because you can do save states, which is boss.
It is, especially in this game, I think, I actually found myself using them for the first time, like really kind of abusing them for the first time on this game.
Yeah, that's cool. Ain't nothing wrong with that. Look, these games are old, man.
Yeah, they're old and they're brutal.
They're not so hard that you need to justify like a $30 purchase anymore. Like, it's just $4. Like, let me blow through it and move on to the next weekly black and white video game.
Mm-hmm. The other game that I played this past week, actually just came out a few days ago, is Serious Sam Double D. And this is the newest game from our friend Nathan Fouts at Mommy's Best Games, a former guest here on RFN, the creator of Weapon of Choice and Shoot One Up and Explosion Aid, all on the Xbox Live Indie Games channel. And Serious Sam Double D is actually on Steam right now. I don't know if it's coming to consoles at all, but being on Steam, it's actually more accessible for more people, so I'm not complaining at all. It's $7, and it's basically Weapon of Choice 2.
Mm-hmm.
Which is glorious, because I love Weapon of Choice. So it's a really hilarious 2D artwork with a lot of like camera zooming in and out type stuff, a lot of scaling. Insane weapons, bullets everywhere, enemies just running at you screaming for no reason, really funny writing, and a lot of heavy metal music. And also very clever 2D level design. The kind that you wish you saw more of, you know? Mm-hmm. It's really, really good. And we've talked a lot about this guy's games before. And one of the things I mentioned that I really like about Mommy's Best Games is that, you know, you see the promo stuff for it or you hear about it in advance and it has some kind of hook that sounds really fun. Some kind of gimmick or some feature that's unique. And the one that they promoted really heavily in Serious Sam is the gun stacker, which is just literally a way to stack guns on top of each other so you can shoot like 5 shotguns at the same time. Mm-hmm. Which is really funny, very effective. It looks absurd on the screen, which is the best part. And it adds a little bit of strategy to the gameplay. But the funny thing about these guys is that there's always that thing which pulls you in, and then you buy the game and you start playing it and you get three levels deep and you find out that there's this whole other really interesting mechanic that is in there that the game leverages very heavily that you never heard about. They didn't advertise it at all. It's just a total surprise. And in this game, it's the jump pad. And John, I know you've got this game. I don't know if you got that far, though.
No, I haven't gotten that far. I've gotten to the point where, I mean, I literally played it for 15 minutes, but I got to the point where you first get the gun stacking icons. So you get your first three. I got to the first spot where you can stack your guns three high. Mm-hmm. Which is great because you stack your guns and they immediately flood the whole screen with enemies to kill.
Right. It's almost like a reverse bullet hell. You're making the bullet hell for the enemies. It's pretty crazy. But the portable jump pad is the secret mechanic in this. And on the PC, you just use the right mouse button to throw it. And it's basically just this jump pad that you just toss out. And it sticks to walls. So you can put it on the floor, but you can put it on walls or the ceiling and do a lot of weird stuff with it. And you can just put it out whenever you want to. And it makes you jump about 50% higher than you normally can. And as soon as you push the button again, the old one disappears and you throw out a new one. So you can actually use this to do some weird wall jumping. If you time it just right, you can make yourself bounce up off the wall and then turn around and throw one on the opposite wall before you come back down. And you can sort of scale a vertical tunnel that way. You can do a lot of weird stuff with it, and it's really fun. And I haven't played a ton of the game. I just got to the dinosaur world, the Jurassic period, and there's some really good jokes that go with that, including Turok and some references to Jurassic Park. But it's a fantastic game. It's so cheap, and I'm so glad that someone is making absurd games like this. I mean, if you like Contra, you have to get this game.
Yeah.
And you have to get weapon of choice too, but you definitely have to get this.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's unique because it's so old school. Like, very few people are making games like this these days. And it's just...
Exactly.
And, you know, all of his games have the same kind of, like, hand-drawn artwork, so it all has a very specific look, which is just great. I mean, it doesn't look like anything else on the market.
Yeah, and the characters are really funny, too. I mean, you've got the giant nude women with bombs for hands that they hold in front of their chest so you can't see their breasts.
Yeah.
And they're headless, too, and they scream at you. You have the jetpack monkeys that launch grenades at you. They're not monkeys, they're gorillas. And they launch grenades at you, and there's the flapjack monster that has a bunch of vuvuzelas stuck into it for some reason, and it explodes when you kill it. The game just has this twisted, bizarre sense of humor that's very refreshing, and it's really good stuff. So definitely check out Serious Sam Double D. Chris, I thought you could go next maybe and tell us about a little 3DS game that we are not allowed to play.
That's right, and won't be for some time apparently. I just recently on a plane trip, I finally finished up playing Professor Layton and the Mask of Miracles, which is the fifth game. The fourth game, of course, is coming out in about a month and a half here in America. But this is the fifth one, and it's the first one for the 3DS. The fact that it took me this long to finish it should probably be an indication of the game's quality. I think it's good. I think it's the weakest game in the series. The story I was not really into. It wasn't as... oh, gee, I wonder what's going to happen. You know, it was actually very predictable. The puzzle designs, I mean, I'll get into sort of what makes the game unique, but it seems like they were kind of running out of gas with these puzzles. Like, they have to come up with, like, 200 brand new puzzles every year when they make these games.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in Layton 5, you know, there were some that were good, but it seemed to be less about, like... I mean, I was watching... We just posted this trailer on Wired that's kind of goes over moments from the first three Layton games leading to the release of the fourth one. And I'm remembering all these puzzles going, like, oh, yeah, those puzzles were so fun. And these puzzles generally tend to be, like, either, like... you know, logic puzzles where it's like, oh, divide up this chessboard so that, you know, there's an equal number of pieces in each of the quadrants kind of thing, instead of, like, interesting kind of like the remember how, you know, the thing used to have logic puzzles where, like, somebody would say something and you'd have to figure out, you know, some secret based on some little aspect of what they were saying? Those are gone. You know, and it's all, like, math problems, and it's all, like, rearranging pieces and stuff like that, because I think they've just kind of, like, you know, run out of a lot of those very clever puzzles. So it's a lot of stuff that I don't know. It seems like when I go into a new puzzle, it was, you know, some of them are very interesting, but some of them just felt tedious. Almost like I've played this game like 5 times now, you know? What's interesting about 3DS is that it puts everything on the top screen when you're in the map, so you don't touch the map anymore to find things. You actually use the bottom screen as like a slide pad. So you slide the stylus around, and you use it like a mouse, like it moves a cursor on the top screen, and you tap the screen when the cursor is over the right, you know, place to investigate it. And because I think they were building these really nice, like, 3D settings for you to explore, they built fewer of them, so the world is a little bit smaller, you do a little bit more backtracking, a little bit less exploring. And overall, it feels like, I mean, to be fair, I may be a little different because I've played every Japanese one and every American one, so this Ooh. Is actually the 8th time I've gone from start to finish.
Yeah, that sounds like total burnout.
Yeah. Yeah. In you know, the first one came out in what, 2006? So it's eight games in 4 or 5 years or so. Yeah. So might be a little bit more burnout for me. But even so, I felt that this one was kind of weak. And I'm looking for, either way, you know, whether I'm right or I'm wrong, I'm looking forward to Professor Layton versus Phoenix Wright. To just re-energize the series a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think they just, I don't know what it is, but I think they kind of, they slowed down with this one, and they've kind of run out of, they've run out of steam. They have been flogging it, you know, just tremendously.
It seems like they could have been rushed as well, because this was a launch title in Japan for 3DS.
It was, yeah. Yep, came out day one, you know, arguably the biggest game that came out for the launch of the 3DS, and you're absolutely right. I mean, they probably had to get it done in a certain amount of time, and they had to do it in such a way that, you know, people didn't buy it and they weren't overtly disappointed. Like, it didn't, you know, I mean, the time on my clock was 31 hours.
Ooh, that seems like a lot for Layton.
Yeah. It is. And that was a lot of, like, certainly I definitely always tried to find every puzzle, but I haven't done any of the side content yet. You know, none of the extra puzzles at the end. You know, that was just 31 hours was getting to the end credits, and it felt really long. And again, the story didn't really seem like it was going anywhere that I really liked. Still a very good game series, but kind of a letdown. And maybe just way too many games too soon.
Well, I think they've avoided some of that in the West because they brought the games over more slowly.
They have.
It seems like they've spread them out more. I mean, Chris, you can really speak to this since you played both versions, but don't they typically develop new puzzles for the Western versions? Some new puzzles?
They had to with the first one because there were a lot of puzzles that did not make any sense if you tried to translate them out of Japanese. Mm-hmm. They were all centered around the Japanese language. From about the second game on, they realized, level 5, you know, while they were developing the game, realized they were going to be translated into other languages, and they stopped doing any puzzles that were tied to some element of the Japanese language, such that the games could be more easily translated. So, if any puzzles are changed, it's not going to be many of them. There was nothing in this game, certainly, that had anything to do with any specific element or pun or play on words in the Japanese language. There aren't even anything. There's no puzzles anymore where you write an answer out. You know, it used to be you'd have to look at a logic puzzle and come up with some word that answered the puzzle. And I mean, that used to be all the time. The puzzles would be like, they'd show you a picture and give you a block of text, and you just sit there and just sort of think and stare and ponder it over and go over it in your head and have that aha moment, you know? But with these puzzles, it's either something interactive that you have to sit there and fiddle with, mm-hmm. or it comes down to kind of a, you know, a math problem. I'm not saying there's not straight up kind of logic problems, but because they've trended away from language, probably in an attempt to get the games, you know, make them a little more easier to localize. And again, not just America, because they're so popular in Europe that they to consider, they have to localize these things into like 5 languages at least. That they, I think, have moved away from some of the puzzle designs that got me interested in it in the first place.
One thing that when we've talked about Layton in the past, one thing we've noted is that at least over the first 3 games, the stories seem to get more and more incredibly bizarre and unpredictable. By the end of the end of the third game is completely insane.
Mm-hmm.
Since you've played much deeper into the series than the rest of us, could you comment on whether that trend continues or do they settle down a little bit with the fourth or the fifth game?
I will tell you that the fourth game definitely trends into crazy town. But the fifth game, interestingly enough, you know, the fifth game is, and obviously the Professor Layton games all have these moments of like, they were all robots. It's like, but that doesn't explain anything. How do you create a town full of like 2,000 robots? That is not an explanation. That's just baloney. And so, of course, in Layton 5, you have those moments where, like, he explains. He's like, actually, here's what he did. And it's just like, oh, we see it. And it's like, I don't see how he could do that at all. But if you look past that a little bit, I think Layton 5 does have more of a human story to it, where it doesn't get ridiculously fantastical. And it actually is just sort of about people. And maybe that's a good thing. At the same time, as I said, I kind of found the story a little bit predictable, and I didn't really find myself like in love with any of the new characters.
Ladies and gentlemen, James Jones.
Hi.
James is here. He's out of breath.
Yes.
He made a great effort to be on this first segment because, among other things, he wanted to talk to Chris about Professor Layton. Unfortunately, he missed most of that conversation. But
damn
James,
it.
if you have any questions for Chris, Chris is probably one of the world's greatest experts on this series. So do you have any inquiries you want to lob?
So you've played the fourth game as well. So
yeah.
Is the London Life segment actually good? And is Europe actually missing something?
I never played the London Life thing. I finished the fourth game and then I was like, I'll play London Life. And then I never did. And then the fifth game came out and I basically forgot about it. Until they announced that the American one was going to unlock it from the beginning, and I was like, "Okay, great, I'll just pick it up. I'll pick it up there." So I don't know. I know. Don't you think I should have played that? And yet somehow I totally missed it.
Conceptually, it's very weird that they put what essentially is a beta for another game they're making in a game that would have sold well enough without it.
Well, what is it for? Fantasy Life? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, it's basically the Fantasy Life formula before Fantasy Life came out.
Right.
Fantasy Life still isn't out.
Yeah.
Well, they probably thought it would have been out. That's the thing, because Fantasy Life started as a DS game.
With Mother 3 style graphics, which is like what this has, right?
Right. And then they eventually decided to move it to 3DS. So at the time they were doing Layton 4, they probably thought that Fantasy Life would come up pretty soon after. They probably thought this would be a good promotional tool. And then it turns out that not so much.
You know, or maybe James is right about it being a beta. You know what I mean? Like about it being a stealth beta for them to get opinions from fans about the style and the type of gameplay.
But does Level 5 really need to second guess their ability to make RPGs?
I think when they're doing something that sounds so unique, yeah.
It's a weird concept
really?
As a game.
I didn't know it was that off the
It's basically
path.
You walk around and help people, if I recall. It's a bit...
Captain Rainbow.
Captain Rainbow-ish, yeah.
Right.
But not quite so Captain Rainbow-ish.
Okay, well, that's another good reason. I mean, I have to say right now, you know, I skipped the second Layton game. I would probably be inclined to skip the fourth one and wait for the fifth one, but based on what Chris is saying about the fifth one, and based on the inclusion of London Life and how interesting that sounds, maybe I will pick up the fourth one.
James, do you have any more questions?
I was curious how the 3D is used, but I'm guessing that probably got answered in the podcast already, so I'll go listen to that.
There's a couple of puzzles that have, the 3D, the puzzles always have some kind of a 3D, you know, display going on, like when you're looking at them. But in general, of course, you're interacting with things on the touchscreen, so the 3D display is not quite interactive. But then when you're walking around the map, the navigation is different. You have a little tiny map on the bottom screen, then you click where you want to go and he walks around. It looks like the Super Mario World map. Is exactly what it looks like. And you move from dot to dot, and that's how you move from place to place. Instead of clicking on the screen, I want to go up, I want to go left, I want to go right. And so then when you look at the top screen, it shows the area you're in 3D. Then you use the touchscreen to drag the stylus around, which drags a magnifying glass cursor around the top screen, so you can click on things.
Oh.
Because basically, it wants to show you the good stuff in 3D, but then you can't interact directly with it, so it has to make all that interaction one layer of abstraction deep, basically.
Huh. Interesting.
Do you like how everything looks in polygons?
Yeah. Oh, it looks beautiful. It's really fun to use the 3D because everything looks like a little toy box diorama. This is one of the best games, I think, for the 3D effect. And I think it's a shame, you know, it didn't come out earlier in the U.S. because I think a lot of the people who were playing, like, really fast-paced games and are like, I don't want to use the 3D. It's really nice to use the 3D on a game where you're not just trying to follow characters around, where everything is very slow-paced and you're just looking at pretty pictures.
Right.
Because then you can really crank the 3D right up and just enjoy it.
So it seems like 3D would be a really good fit for kind of a classic-style RPG, James, right? I mean, that's what you've been playing on 3DS, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be great. I can see why this would be perfect. Nice segue there, Johnny.
I teed you up. Knock it out of the park.
Yeah, so I'm playing Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor Overclocked, which is a DS game on 3DS, which is still a DS game on 3DS.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to what Johnny said, you know, putting nice 3D visuals on there. They took an entirely, I would say, Atlassian approach and just turned the 3D screen off for multiple parts of the game.
So it's just it's a 2D DS game slapped on a 3DS cartridge.
Yes, that is exactly what this game is.
What upgrades does it offer?
So in the game, the premise is you collect demons to battle other demons. It's your Shin Megami Tensei stuff. But the 3D upgrades involve when you merge demons, which you can do in all of the games I've played. It's now in 3D. The cards fly around in 3D. That's it.
Well, whoop-de-doo.
Yeah, it's as far as I could tell, it is an impressive visual upgrade that now makes the game still look like a GBA Mega Man Battle Network game.
Wow.
I mean, the gameplay itself is convoluted as hell, because there's all these weird things you can do to customize your demon teams, and they have these skills that affect the battle. And although it wants to give them to me in a glacial pace, I'm generally enjoying the combat mechanics and the weird, screwed-up story. But it's so distracting that this is not even a visually good DS game on the 3DS, and that all the action is on the bottom screen, despite the fact there's no real reason to use the touchscreen. At the very least, they could have moved it up, but then they would have had to draw the hand-drawn stuff, what had to be expanded.
To fill the screen.
Yeah. It right. is a phenomenally lazy port that makes Rayman 3D look, like, ambitious.
Wow.
Which, after I spent about 20 minutes on this show slamming how utterly lacking ambition that port is,
yeah,
this is impressive.
Finally, somebody just took a DS game and crapped it onto the 3DS. And
it's finally happened. It's some sort of like milestone.
It's funny because this seems like a game that James might otherwise like quite a bit, but the way in which it's being presented really could not be more infuriating to James.
Oh, yeah. the utter lack of effort is so everywhere that even if you're having fun, you're going, yeah, but... Mm. Mm. When I say they turn the 3D screen off, I am absolutely not exaggerating in the slightest. There are significant portions of the game where the top screen is simply off. Black.
Wow.
It's off.
Yes.
Okay, so it's not like it's displaying graphics in 2D.
No, it is off.
What would the if you were playing the DS game, what it would just show you stuff on the bottom screen?
Presumably yes. And I would guess the DS screen turns the top screen off in certain moments too, like when the characters are talking on the bottom screen.
Okay. Oh, right. Okay. Well, I mean, jeez, that's a mess.
But in this point, there's this big screen up there that's staring you in the face, doing nothing.
Yeah.
And when it is on, it's just displaying what looks like a red standard Windows background that you get when your computer boots up with like a tessellation on it.
It's the pipe screensaver. It's a 3D
pipe. It's a disaster. It's unparalleled levels of laziness.
You know, I can imagine a couple reasons why this might, I mean, releasing this game, re-releasing on 3DS might be somewhat defensible. I mean, first off, the main thing is it's an Atlas game. So it's probably difficult to find in the first place. They rarely reprint their games.
I might have the only copy and they sent it to us. So
yeah, like if you missed out the first time and you really wanted to play Devil Survivor, this is another chance to get your own copy of it.
For $40.
So I mean, it's somewhat respectable in that, although it would have probably made more sense to just put it on DS.
Yeah, or just make more copies and put the little sticker on there, also plays on 3DS.
And I say this kind of jokingly, but the fact that it is an actual 3DS cartridge means that you can use the home screen overlay and some other stuff.
I can search how to beat these enemies.
Right, you could go to the browser, which you can't do in a DS game.
Right, so I suppose I can understand, like, look, if you're going to buy this game on the DS, but you have a 3DS, you might as well just buy this version instead for the little minor kind of upgrades that you can enjoy with it.
I suppose there's probably some added content, although I don't know the specifics of it.
It's probably like post-game stuff that you have to play for 100 hours before you can access.
That would be nice if they were somehow able to, you know, if it was like one of those games that works on the Game Boy or the Game Boy Color, you know, if you popped a DS card into your 3DS and suddenly it had hooks for the 3DS that let you jump out and use the home menu or look at the browser or whatever, right? I mean, that would be one thing. But when you go to the store and you buy a game that says Nintendo 3DS on it, you expect a certain level of quality. And the excuse, it's just a DS game, but it's upgraded, that doesn't really fly. When you get it home and you put it in and there's nothing on the 3D screen.
It's a weird review that I'm going to have to handle, because at some point I'm going to have to say, well, the gameplay is nice, and
if this was on DS, I would give it this score.
Yeah, I mean, it might come down to that.
Yeah.
What's funny is the story itself is about a disaster in Japan that the government is covering up and not providing good information to the people who are kind of on the edge of panic, but they're so concerned with being orderly, they're not there yet, even though their government is currently lying to them or withholding information. I'm like, wow, this is a little uncomfortable. It's got a nice mechanic to it, but it's got bad rhythm and it's a horrible port, and that's unfortunately where this game's going to wind up for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's too bad. So still not a good 3DS game worth buying. There's Star Fox, which is a good 3DS
Star
game,
Fox.
But it's not worth buying.
Oh, I see.
Oh, okay.
That's where I come down on that. But
I got you.
It's going to be a while, folks.
Well, like 2 months.
Yeah, we've already been waiting 2 months or more.
2 months too long.
Well, I don't think it's much better in Japan, actually. But all of that's going to change when TGS rolls around, which we'll talk about after this break.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, first up we have a review for Star Fox 64 3D by Neil.
It's $40.
Yeah,
it's $40.
That's the review.
And you get to find out if that is if it's worthwhile or not.
You get your face over your R-Wing when you kill a bitch.
Dual barrel.
You know, and what Neil says, and I completely agree, is if you've never played Star Fox 64, this is probably the best way to do it, and it's an amazing game, and you should pick it up.
All right, and we also have on the recommendation front, we have Carmine makes a triumphant return to the site.
Yay.
With Ignition Factor, a Super Nintendo game on Virtual Console.
Next up, we have a review of Captain America Super Soldier on the Wii by Josh Max. Between Thor and Captain America, a couple of these superhero video games turned out to be okay this summer, so you can find out if this is one of them. We also got the weekly Japan eShop Roundup by Danny Bivens, and you will definitely want to check that out because, as you might have heard, Japan gets more and better stuff on the eShop than the rest of us do.
Well, certainly they get crazier stuff on the eShop than we do.
Yes, and Danny also does a great job of describing not only the new games and the paid demos and all the other crazy stuff they put out there, but the all the videos that they put up on the Nintendo Video Channel, some of which are definitely more interesting than the stuff we get in the West.
Any of them are more interesting than the stuff we get.
Yeah.
We have a bevy of Star Fox content.
All Star Fox, all the time.
We have an Extra Life for Star Fox Command by James Dawson. Johnny's talked about Star Fox Command on this show.
Yes.
It's the DS Star Fox game in which you command things.
It's from the same developer as the new 3DS remake of 64.
More Star Fox up in here. We have an editorial called Fading Mr. Fox by Scott Thompson. It is a treatise on the decline of the Star Fox character.
It is a hell of an editorial.
More of a manifesto.
Yes.
We also have a feature, which is quite the opposite of the Fading Mr. Fox, called Star Fox characters, my pilots, my friends, from Josh Max, which is an examination of the various co-pilots of the Star Fox franchise, and includes the phrase, "Seriously, Slippy, learn how to fly an R-Wing, you built them, you dumbass." Lastly, this week we have a blog called The Second Circle Pad and Kid Icarus Uprising by Neil, in which he examines this game that we all felt has control issues and how that the recently announced, pseudo-announced, shell/second analog stick could affect the Kid Icarus gameplay in this entirely theoretical exercise that may or may not apply.
All right, well, that's all the great original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Be sure to check it all out, not after the show, during the show, right now. Go check it out, NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back to the show. It's time for our newest segment, What the Fuck is Going On with Japan Lately? Starring Chris Kohler.
Oh, hello. Nice to be here.
I don't think this segment's going to last very long.
No, it's a one-off, I have to say. But it seemed like, actually, we were already thinking of having Chris on the show since we're recording on a different night. And then all of this insanity started happening in Japan.
Crazy.
And it's just
crazy shit.
What great providence that we have Chris on this week.
It is
wonderful.
Truly providence.
It's almost like, where do we even start? I mean, I have three big stories here. One of them is our TGS preview, so we can save that to the end. That's partly speculation, but the newest news that came out, and I'm sure it'll still be fairly fresh when this podcast goes up on Sunday, but just last night we saw the scan from Famitsu of the 3DS cradle with, as it was foretold, a second slide pad on the right side of the handheld, and a sort of a hidden R2 button as well, so it adds a shoulder button as well as a second joystick.
There is so much acid being taken in Nintendo right now.
Apparently it brings you up to, what I've heard is that it brings you up to 4 shoulder buttons. You can still hit the L1 with this thing on, then it adds an L2, another R1, and an R2, because it covers over that part of it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I didn't know there was an L2 as well.
Because the idea is that it transposes, Capcom can bring out Monster Hunter 3 and just simply transpose the controls from the classic controller Wii version right onto the 3DS, right. So it's all just identical.
Because the controls are so good that it's worth it.
You know, I don't get it. I don't play it. The Japanese are madly in love with it.
I'm glad that there's a port for the 3DS, though, because there weren't any of these on the system already.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, I understand that Nintendo wants the series on their system. I always assume Monster Hunter would come to 3DS, because
yeah,
Capcom
so
in general has been increasingly liberal about the platforms that they're willing to distribute this series across. So, I mean, it's on Xbox 360 in Japan. So, I'm not surprised that it's coming to 3DS. I always expected that. But do we really need another version of Monster Hunter 3? I mean, is this really worth just this Frankenstein modification of the entire control system of the handheld just to play the game exactly as it already exists on other systems?
Apparently. Well, no, I mean, it's the Wii version, right? It's not the same thing as the PSP Monster Hunter Portable 3rd G.
Yeah, the PSP one was a sort of a dumbed-down version of the Wii game with, you know, simpler controls.
And no underwater, which apparently is a big deal in Japan that this version has underwater.
Yeah, because the underwater stuff in Tri is bad. I don't understand why anybody would want to do that.
You just don't understand how brilliant it really is.
It's very avant-garde swimming.
Yeah.
You have to live in Japan to understand how amazing it is.
Right. I'm sorry. I apologize, and I'm sure people are going to be listening to this going, you have 4 guys talking about Monster Hunter who apparently don't play it and don't
John
understand.
Plays it.
I've played it quite a bit, actually.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it's terrible. I think it's repetitive. I think that the camera controls, you get used to them. I'll put it this way. It is not a paragon of camera design.
You get used to having a broken leg. It doesn't make it good.
Exactly.
My understanding is that, you know, the Japanese kids get together after school and they don't go over to somebody's house and play games. They just go sit in a restaurant or whatever for like 5 hours and they just all sit there with their PSPs and play Monster Hunter.
Yeah, I can understand that.
You know, clearly they're trying to capture some of that and move that over onto the 3DS. And whoever it was, Nintendo, Capcom, whatever, felt that they didn't want to port it down to the 3DS's controls. They wanted the full-on whole thing. And here's the other thing with this cradle. We've not heard very much about it. We've only seen this Famitsu scan. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be too shocked if there was, like, an extra battery in there.
I would hope so.
to give people more juice for those extended, because they'd sit there and play these games for a long time, right? So you get more juice out of it. Maybe your session goes up to 6 or 7 hours of gameplay instead of like 3.
Otherwise, the restaurant industry is going to be killed.
Yeah.
I'm not pissed about it, because I think I know a lot of people are pissed about this, and I don't really understand that reaction to it, because for me it's like, this seems like something that only Monster Hunter will use, and it'll be optional, and it'll probably never even be released outside of Japan. It's just, it's odd, and the announcement of it was horribly handled. I mean, you do not want a pirate scan of Famitsu to be the way that the world finds out about something like this.
Oh, good lord, no. No. And I mean, Jesus Christ, this happens all the time. Whenever something is in Famitsu, the first thing you get is somebody grabs a copy and they take a photograph of the page. It's like, this was a message that they really needed to control, and they really, really did not. They screwed the pooch is what they did.
Yeah. Presumably, this is the big announcement that they're going to be making there. I mean, it's hard to believe that it could be anything bigger than this.
Yeah.
So.
No, I disagree. I disagree. I think that this is a thing that's going to be included with every copy of Monster Hunter 3. Mm-hmm. I do not think that this is some big new push that Nintendo is making. I think if it was, it wouldn't be in Famitsu. You know, I think this is one thing they're going to announce is Monster Hunter 3 and this, but this is there's no way that this is like a press conference all about, we're sorry, we fucked up. Here's some shit to put on your 3DS.
At Nintendo, we add large plastic to our handhelds.
I mean, someone really needs to hold it up to their head like a taco phone.
Probably Billy will do that.
Yeah.
Billy was one of the originators of the N-Gage side-talking photos.
Side-talking.
The rumors that come out of Nintendo lately are accurate so much in the last, say, year that it's kind of amazing.
Mm-hmm. Especially from 01net. I mean, these guys clearly have some well-placed sources.
They have killed it.
Yeah, and the one part of their rumor that is still we're still not sure about as of this recording time is they said this add-on would be roughly $10, which definitely supports the idea that this thing is pretty much just physical buttons. Like, there would be no battery upgrade in it.
Yeah, true.
And it also supports the idea that this could be easily packed in with a game. And
yes.
You know, the game would cost a little bit extra, but they're going to charge whatever the fuck they want to charge for Monster Hunter anyway.
I wonder if it's going to be $10 more for the game with it versus without it.
Well, I don't think you'll be able to buy it without it.
Exactly. I mean, it may simply be the fact that, like, you may just not be able to play the game without it. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. This may not even come to America, you know?
Right.
I mean, this might be something that only stays in Japan. In Japan, you know, the concept of a one-off controller that attaches to the system and is used to play one game is not that new of a concept, and it's not that crazy of a concept either. I mean, you have all kinds of, like, crazy peripherals and things like that, and very few of them really end up making their way outside of Japan. It's a lot easier to do it there, right? So because this is so... It's not like it's a Dance Dance Revolution controller or something like that. It looks very, it's like something people have been asking for. You know, they want a second analog stick in the 3DS. People see it and they assume that it's not just a special controller for a game, as they would if it was a Dance Dance Revolution controller or a pair of maracas or something. You know, they see it as like some kind of a major strategy shift from Nintendo. Maybe it is. Maybe Nintendo has lost their minds and that this is like a huge, like, this is the big push. But I don't think so. I think that they understand
that... Maybe they played Kid Icarus and realized how terrible it is without a second
analog
stick.
I think Kid Icarus is a bad game regardless of having only one joystick.
Yeah, I wasn't very impressed by it.
I don't know. You know, maybe they're going to take this and they're going to bundle this in with Kid Icarus. You know, who knows? I mean, maybe they will. But I really am going to be very curious to see what happens at their press conference. And when I say see, I mean that in a metaphorical sense, because they're not inviting the foreign press into their press conference.
Well, they're going to live stream it like Square did.
Yes. So I can live blog it from my hotel room a few blocks away in Tokyo. Yes, that's right. Nintendo is even region locking the news.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It sounds like you're kind of the opinion that this is sort of like a Saturn analog controller for Knights that is not really used in other games after that. It's just this one special deal.
Yeah, nobody uses add-on controllers ever. I mean, even the Wii Motion Plus, which is, honest to God, I mean, that has had the most effort put behind its marketing and pushing it and trying to get developers to make games for it, including it in the box with so many games that require it. And how many games use it? Like 10?
A dozen, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, right. And even then, if you buy a game that uses it, the odds are very, very high that it just comes in the box, you know? So, no, you can't make people buy an accessory like this, and you can't get all of your user base to use it. Now, again, if, God forbid, these people have brain damage and they announce the 3DS 2 or the 3DS XL or whatever, and it has 4 shoulder buttons built in and a circle pad built in, and every single person that bought a 3DS 1 is like on the receiving end of having just bought like the beta version of the real 3DS. That would be, and I don't see that happening because
it would be corporate suicide.
Yeah.
just imagine trying to sell those same people a Wii U a year later.
That's the thing with
this is the single touch Wii U. We're gonna have a multi-touch one that comes out in 6 months.
And it really puts them in an interesting situation, you know, the 3DS, the price drop with the Wii U's price, doesn't it? Because like if they bring out the Wii U and it's again $250, the exact launch price of the 3DS, how many people are gonna look at that and go, I don't think I'm gonna buy this, because the last time they did this, they lowered the price by $100 and 6 months.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you might get a bunch of Super Nintendo games if you buy it early, but
a bunch of emulated GameCube titles. That's more likely.
This is the beta version of the Luigi's Mansion emulator. You can't save. Yeah, all the boos are invisible.
You don't need to save in Luigi's Mansion.
I already proved that. Thank you.
Okay, well, yeah, this thing, it is confusing. I think the big issue is that we had no context for this news, because it was basically a stolen, not a stolen, but it was a leaked story, and, you know, it was in Japanese, so people were frantically trying to translate it, and little pieces were coming out, and even now, even, you know, the next day, there's still so many questions. And for any other system, this probably wouldn't cause such a furor, but because the future of 3DS is so uncertain, and it's been through so much turmoil already in less than a year, I think people are reacting much more strongly to this than they would have otherwise, especially by the perceived notion, probably erroneous, that this is kind of some kind of telegraph of their system becoming outdated right after they bought it.
Yeah, so while we were talking, possibly not literally, but while we were talking, I was sent an email for the just-launched Monster Hunter 3G website. Interestingly enough, nowhere on the website does it have any, it has a regular 3DS without the big giant salad bar attachment on the side playing the game. Hmm. On the top screen, thankfully, with the 3D light on, just if you're curious.
Okay. Interesting. News breaking in real time as we do this podcast.
But apparently, judging from this, you can play it without the giant attachment.
Okay.
Or they just weren't allowed to talk about it, and they launched a website instead that puts some monsters there.
Okay. Very interesting that it's not necessary to use the crazy thing.
So I guess you would use the touchscreen probably for camera control.
Yeah.
So I could almost see a situation where the game is $10 more if you want the crazy thing. Mm-hmm. And I think people would probably pay that premium because, I mean, if you're going to play 100 hours of Monster Hunter, then it's probably worth it.
I kind of hope that they don't support playing it without the cradle, because that means that they're going to have to sell the cradle separately so that you can buy it after the fact.
Yeah.
And that means that it will exist as its own product on the market, and other developers might get the idea that they should try to support it too. And then we're just down a terrible rabbit hole that I'd rather not get into, because the 3DS does not need this thing.
I hope we get another release of Star Fox 64 that supports it.
I mean, I'm not saying I would have complained if the 3DS did have two joysticks. I would have been perfectly fine with that. But as an attachment, as an after the fact, oops, we should have thought of this earlier. Here's an accessory. That's a bad idea. The 3DS, there's plenty of stuff you can do on this system that just needs to be done. They just need to make games, period. Yep. They don't need more joysticks in order to fill out the library of 3DS. They just need to make games
everywhere.
Yeah, I think Nintendo is kind of getting a bad rep for just being complete peripheral-holics now.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, we'll bring out, you know, these Wii Remotes, but a couple years down the line, they'll all be Wii Remote Pluses, but don't worry about it.
don't worry about it. You won't have any games that use it anyway.
Yeah, exactly. We'll come out with it, so you'll feel like you'll need it, but then we won't make any games for it, which will make it even worse.
There is an interesting parallel with Monster Hunter 3G and Monster Hunter Tri, in that when they announced Tri is when we first heard about the Classic Controller Pro. And then we had that weird E3 2009 where a Pro mysteriously appeared at Nintendo's press desk and nobody knew how it got there.
I love that story.
Yeah, true. I mean, the Classic Controller Pro, I mean, as far as I understand it, was for Monster Hunter.
Mm-hmm. Well, sure it was, but it was...
It was useful, though, for a lot of other things.
It was nice. I mean, the handles make it really nice. Yeah. But the original Classic Controller already has two joysticks, and it already has four shoulder buttons, although they're not well-placed.
Yeah, it was a pretty awful design, really.
Yeah, the Classic Controller has issues. You know, the cord comes out the wrong side.
And the way it's, you know, kind of like curved and like underneath, it has that weird rounded bottom.
Yeah, I like the Pro, but I play Super Nintendo games with it.
You know, one thing that might make that cradle good, though, because we don't know the ergonomics of it. I wouldn't mind if it's actually got a little bit more width to it, because I feel like holding the 3DS for extended periods can be kind of uncomfortable.
Well, you can see it is wider. I mean, it makes the system wider.
Yeah, but I mean, it's how that width feels, I guess, is the question.
And, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that kind of is a lot of it. You know, let's remember here that we're talking about, and it's the same thing with the Classic Controller Pro, it was designed for extended play sessions. And, I mean, that could really be a lot of the bulk that this thing adds is making it more comfortable to sit there for a long time playing Monster Hunter holding 3DS. Sony redesigned, again, like, this is the power of this game. It's like the only fucking game that the Japanese play anymore. That Sony redesigned the PSP only in Japan just for Monster Hunter with concave analog nubs and, you know, broader kind of...
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, no, you remember it was a Tokyo Game Show last year. We never heard hide nor hair of it in the US because it was only for Monster Hunter. It was this really comfortable PSP. It was pretty cool, actually. But, you know, that is the power of this game. That, I mean, Capcom is just like,
listen... It shapes hardware design for years to come.
Our players demand that they play this game with such and such controls, and Nintendo and Sony thus far have been like, okay, we'll make whatever you want.
It does make me wonder why Capcom makes anything else except Monster Hunter games at this point.
Okay, well, let's move on to the next gigantic topic of discussion here, which is Dragon Quest X. Just announced a couple of days ago. We knew it was coming.
But re-announced.
It was kind of prepped. We knew that there'd be footage of it in the Dragon Quest collection that's coming out soon in Japan, and then Square Enix said, you know, we're just going to have this big press conference and announce something, and we kind of all knew that it would be Dragon Quest X. So the basics are, it's coming to Wii in 2012. There will also be a Wii U version, kind of upgraded version. We don't know if that's going to be next year or the year after that. And one or both of those versions will have some kind of 3DS download feature as well. There'd probably be some kind of temporary save or installing some kind of Street Pass data file on your 3DS so you can exchange Street Pass and then transfer that back to the console version. But it doesn't seem like you'll actually be able to play the game on 3DS.
You cannot. You cannot. They've said that you're not copying the game to your 3DS to play it. It's a special program, whatever.
Right. Yeah, which is not to say that there won't eventually be a 3DS version. I could see that happening, but that's not been announced at this time.
It does feel like they were paid to hit every platform they could.
I think they're just trying to hedge their bets a little bit, too.
Yeah. At this point, this game has been so long in development that they got to the point where it's like, well, we announced it for the Wii. We're not going to make it a launch title for a new platform because that's not what Dragon Quest ever is.
Sup, Twilight Princess.
They had to bring it out for the console that everybody already had, but at the same time, if they realized that was going to make it super dated, so they had to announce now that they indeed will make two versions and that there'll be an upgraded version for the Wii U, but they had to make the Wii version.
Yeah, and we don't really know how the Wii U version will be upgraded. I mean, it'll have some kind of HD conversion, but it's not like they're going to redo all the art assets, so I don't think it's going to end up looking that much different.
It's going to, you know what, it'll run in 1080p or whatever, 720p, you know, it'll run in high def. Here's my prediction. I bet you that whatever this thing is, you know, whatever the Wii version of this is, or the Wii U version of this is, or however you use the touchscreen, one of the options is going to be play the whole thing on the Wii U controller without using the television.
Sure.
Because I think this is the perfect kind of test bed for that idea of like, okay, well, little sister, you can use the television set. I'm going to spend, you know, 10 hours playing my MMO, and I'll just use the controller to do it, you know, and I'll just sort of make it personal so I can interact with my friends and nobody's watching the TV and watching me do that. So I think that they're going to go for, and I think this makes sense because it's an upport, right? So it's not like they're going to be doing anything super fancy with like, oh, I mean, maybe they will. Maybe they're going to have a mode where it's like, you know, you play on the TV and then the Wii U has all of your stats, whatever. But like, I can really, really see them having people play this whole thing because it's like the proof of concept of this idea that, especially in Japan, we can make gaming more personal in the home by letting you have your own personal screen that nobody else has to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's perfect for an RPG.
It is. Because
it's something that you might want to, I mean, and that's the way a lot of us do play games on RPGs on handhelds, is we play it while we watch TV.
Yeah.
So it's perfect for that kind of a thing.
And like virtual keyboard type to your friends. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of potential here for the Wii U version to be maybe something of a killer app for the Wii U. You know, I mean, I think that if they're really on the ball and they get this thing going, they, because this is going to have a subscription cost, right? So let's imagine that, like, it actually kind of takes off in Japan, and they actually build a reasonable, you know, subscriber base of customers who are paying them by the month. Wouldn't you then include it for free with every Wii U? Wouldn't you bundle it right in? Because you're not giving away a game. You're signing people up for a recurring monthly payment.
Yeah.
So I know you can play the game without the online component. The question is, you can't? I thought you could.
I think they said 3 or 4 hours into it.
And what I think they're going to try to do is they're going to try to suck people in and say, you know, here, you can play the first few hours without online.
Oh, that's evil.
Let's say that it was the opposite. So in Japan, a lot of people have not connected their Wii or actually much of anything up to the internet. A lot of people just use their phones, and they just use their phones for internet, and it's not connected to their computer. It's just their awesome smartphone, and that's what they do internet on. And a lot of things in their house are connected to the internet. Let's say you bring home Dragon Quest X, you put it in your Wii, and your Wii says, connect your Wii to the internet. You might just go, ah, I don't want to do that. And you put it away, and maybe you return it to the store, maybe you just never do it. If you start playing the game, and if it's really good, and you play it for 3 hours, and then it's like, to continue, please connect your Wii to the internet, you know, then maybe you've hooked them in. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the plan here.
That makes sense. So we've talked around it, but just in case you haven't heard, the real controversy over this game is that it is some kind of online RPG. I think calling it an MMO is probably disingenuous because I don't think it's going to be very massive. I thought
it was more party based than anything.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I was more in more of a story driven Phantasy Star kind of thing.
Right. And as Chris alluded to, there is going to be a subscription fee, at least in Japan. And I would just say, before you get your panties in a bunch, there is a high likelihood that this game will not have a subscription rate when it's released outside of Japan, because that has been the pattern with Phantasy Star Online. To some extent, in the original versions, there was a subscription fee. In some of the later ones, there wasn't. But certainly with Monster Hunter, as that has come over to the West, they have always done away with the subscription fees.
Yes, but not Square Enix games.
Yeah, they are open to subscription fees.
Does Square Enix really have a game that's comparable to this? Because Final Fantasy XI and XIV are actual MMOs, and that they're a kind of game that Westerners already expect to pay $15 a month for. Dragon Quest X, I don't think fits that bill.
I don't think anybody's paying $15 a month for XIV yet.
Well, no, in theory.
But I think it all depends on, are they charging this because, I mean, they're charging a fee.
Yeah.
No other online game on Wii charges you a fee just to play it. So that's suggesting that we're looking at something here that is deeper and more complicated and more costly for them to run than, like, Smash Brothers.
Monster Hunter 3 charges a fee in Japan.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, yeah. Monster Hunter 3 charges a fee in Japan.
And Capcom had the good sense to say, this will not fly in America. So
right,
we're
we already we have a very limited audience, and we're going to limit it down to almost no one if we try to charge a fee.
Yeah. And that pretty much applies to Dragon Quest as well. It's not a big deal over here.
You know, it does, unless they really are going to be incredibly aggressive about getting this into the hands of players. Again, I don't really know if I don't know if they're going to give this away with every Wii U and
every Nintendo Power subscription.
But I really don't know what Square Enix's thought process here. They seem to be going after this idea of, you know, generating a monthly fee with this. And I don't know if they're looking at Japan right now and they're saying, we're going to charge a monthly fee because we know we can get money out of these people, or if they really are looking at this Dragon Quest X as like another Final Fantasy XI, where they're going to have it all over the world and make a bunch of money. You are right that the fact that Dragon Quest is not as popular outside Japan, like really, really, really not as popular, does probably indicate that it might be a Monster Hunter type situation where there's no fee.
And I'll give you another reason. Dragon Quest is published by Nintendo outside of Japan. So you can say Square
Agreed.
Enix would like to charge a subscription fee in America for Dragon Quest X,
yeah.
but they're probably not going to publish it. And I really, even much far less likely that Nintendo itself would charge a subscription fee for any
game.
Yeah,
there's no way in hell that's happening.
That's fair.
It does, but you know, one thing this does do is it does give us some insight into an extent, at least, of what developers are going to be allowed to do with the Wii U's online strategy.
Well, with the Wii's online strategy, for that matter.
Well, it indicates to me that decentralization is still probably the name of the game.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not going to have the strong, this is Nintendo Online, everything sort of branches off of it, like you see in an Xbox service.
James, I don't think that Nintendo is changing their strategy. I think they're rebranding their strategy. Their strategy for the Wii has been like, we have no online service, do whatever you want, we don't care. The Wii U, it's the exact same strategy, but they're rebranding it as, we have an open online service, and you have the freedom to pursue whatever strategy you want to, and we're not going to lock you down into, you know, Nintendo Live or Nintendo Network. It's whatever it is you want it to be.
Mm-hmm. Public relations sounds like a great job.
Yeah, and what it also means is Nintendo probably won't supply any kind of useful APIs or library-type tools to developers to actually do this stuff. I mean, we were at E3, we were asking a lot of developers, is your 3DS game going to have online? No, we haven't really had support from Nintendo. We don't have the tools from Nintendo to do that. Or some of them actually say, no, Nintendo doesn't really have the online system set up. And I'm like, they're not gonna.
Yeah.
No.
Don't wait on that, because
it's set up already.
Yeah. This is what you get. If you want it to be online, it sounds like you pretty much have to just code it yourself.
Well, what's different now is that a lot of companies are coding it themselves. I mean, what I hope happens is that by open, Nintendo means that, I mean, the problem with Nintendo is they say we're totally open, and then you find out that what they actually mean is that they're like incredibly locked down. You know, it's like when Nintendo said, we'll let you make any game on WiiWare you want to do. We have no concept approval whatsoever. It's like, okay, great. I have a great idea for a game. It's like, are you a company with an office?
Right.
And you have 5 employees? And
are you willing to sign over to us the first $10,000 that this game will generate?
Right, right, right. And this and that, and X, Y, and Z. And it's like, no, I can't do that. It's like, well, sorry, then we're not interested in working with you. It's like, but you said I can make whatever game I want. It's like, yeah, well, if you pass all these requirements, you can. But it's like, yes, but then if I pass all these requirements, I'm Capcom, you know? It's like, then I can't make any game I want because I'm a multi-billion-dollar international corporation. So if Nintendo is serious about letting anybody do anything they want, that's great. Can't wait to buy a Wii U and see Steam on it day one.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be great.
Amen.
And if that doesn't happen, and if Valve comes back and says Nintendo won't let us do that for whatever reason, then you know that it's not actually just open to anybody to do whatever they want to do.
Yeah. But anyway, we've moved too far away from Dragon Quest X, because Dragon Quest X, I have to say, despite all the furor and all the disappointment and all the hand-wringing over the fact that this is online and that there's a subscription fee, at least in Japan, and that it's kind of being spread out over multiple platforms, and it's just a very confusing announcement, I watched a video of the game from the press conference that they did, and I thought it looked awesome. I thought it looked like Dragon Quest, and I thought it looked like something that I sure as hell want to play. And I think it's something that the Wii needs very badly, especially for those of us in America who don't have Xenoblade, who don't have The Last Story, who would like to play a game like this on our Wii. It's, you know, maybe my mouth is a little bit more dry than the rest of the world, but I really want this kind of a game. And I think it's pathetic that it's taken 5-6 years for this kind of thing to come out on the system, but I'm not going to turn it down. And I'm not going to get all pissy because it's not exactly the way that I like Dragon Quest. I mean, I haven't played it yet, so I don't know that I don't like it.
You know, it's kind of an interesting evolution from the a little bit more freeform Dragon Quest IX, where you build your characters and your party to a game that is specifically you are building a character and collecting a party of other similarly built characters, as opposed to moving away from the more pre-constructed characters that are the norm in the JRPG, like in 8 and I guess 7's kind of the same way there.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a transition that they went in 9 where it's freeform to 10 where it's, open season, do whatever the hell you want with your character.
A lot of RPG players are migrating online these days. A lot of them are playing free-to-play games, and a lot of them are playing Warcraft, and a lot of the casual players in Japan are doing social networking and things like that, and I think that they understand that especially, I think, Dragon Quest IX in Japan, and I've made this point in an article, but I think it's very easy for us in America to look at Dragon Quest IX and say, oh, it's good old Dragon Quest again, the old reliable standby Japanese role-playing game. It doesn't change with the times. It's still so simple. And in America, that may be true, but in Japan, the Street Pass functionality completely changed the way that people play Dragon Quest. They took it outside of their homes, and they went to, major locations all around Japan, and they all met up there impromptu, not organized by Square Enix, to meet there and sit there all day and Street Pass. And what this did was, not only did it get them taking the game outside and playing with other people and socializing and kind of enjoying the Dragon Quest experience, but it made them probably play it for a lot longer, than they ordinarily would have. And yeah. I think that was the indicator to Square Enix, like, okay, community-based functionality is going to be important to this game, or there is a way to build, really compelling multiplayer content into a Dragon Quest. And I think they're trying to tackle this in the home versions. They could very easily have just been like, fine, Dragon Quest X, we'll do it the same thing, we'll do street passing again, we'll make it better this time. But they're taking another risk. They're trying to bring it into the home. They're trying to integrate it more into the game. And I think it seems like a very calculated, smart risk to be taking at this point.
I do wonder if the success that you talked about with, proto street passing on Dragon Quest IX, because I guess the term didn't exist yet. I don't remember what we called it at that time, though.
Tag mode.
It was bark mode.
Tag mode was...
Bark mode and Nintendogs, yeah.
I do wonder if the Street Pass mode of this game where you download your character is sort of their way of getting that same community element in person, or at least kind of moving off of that they have.
Oh, that's precisely what it is. I guarantee you that whatever it is they're building, they are building it to recreate the same things that we saw, impromptu springing up around Japan where people would go and gather and exchange data. Because, God... what better promotional tool than you're walking down the street in Akihabara and there's like 200 people all clustered outside a store and you're like, what the hell are they doing? What game are they playing? And it's Japan, yeah. So then you're like, well, I better have it too because...
It's almost literally word of mouth. So, it's awesome marketing for your game, and it's part of the reason Dragon Quest IX was the most successful game ever in that series.
Yes, and they of course they're going to want to recreate that. So they're hedging their bets. Maybe if people are going to play it online, but maybe that's not quite what they want. Maybe they're going to copy it to their 3DS. Note that it's their 3DS, not their DS. They're going to copy it over to their 3DS and take their 3DS. And if they don't have a 3DS, well, they'll just have to go buy one and take it outside and do street passing that way.
Hence Nintendo's involvement with this.
This is very much, I think people look at this and go, oh, Square Enix, you're so dumb. This is Nintendo. They are as much, Iwata stood there holding a fucking arm full of slimes, just the same as anybody. This is Nintendo's deal. They realize this is a big deal. They realize how big Dragon Quest IX was to extend the life of the 3D or the regular DS. And they know that by really pushing forth a combined effort, with Dragon Quest X, working on the Wii and the Wii U and the 3DS, it's going to get a whole lot of attention. And if the game is good, basically saves their asses. So, this is huge. This is it. This is the only thing that's bigger than Monster Hunter. And they have Monster Hunter, too.
Yeah.
One thing I do wonder, though, is I know the game's going to have some level of subscription element to it, but I do wonder if, because, Square Enix also has their... a free-to-play MMO that they use cash shop stuff for. Fantasy Earth, I think is what it's called. And I do wonder if this game will have some element of that in there too, where they have a steady stream of income as opposed to producing a huge, gigantic budget Final Fantasy. What was it? Final Fantasy 13 that took forever to come out and then maybe didn't sell as well as they wanted.
Everybody wants to have that. Everybody wants to have that because Activision wants that. You know, they want it with Call of Duty Elite.
They're
going pretty hard after it. I mean, if you've read, you know, what Call of Duty Elite members are going to get over just the regular non-paying Call of Duty people, like, they're getting a competitive advantage because they're going to have every map and they're going to have it weeks before you do, you know? And mm-hmm. so they're selling a competitive advantage in Call of Duty. And I think that they understand that tons of people are going to want to sign up for that. And I think that Square Enix understands that to have this, they look at, you know, everybody's just looking at Blizzard going, you know, the reason why these guys are just so golden is because they just have this money just flowing in every month.
Well, they don't sell a game, they sell a service.
Yeah, I don't want Dragon Quest to become a service because I don't think Japanese companies have really done a good job of offering gaming services.
Yeah.
So, in general, I don't think it's an art that's not understood in Japan.
You know, I almost would like to see it, you know, if the fee's nominal and they do some kind of optional stuff on there, I could be okay with that, but I really don't want to pay. I still have this reservation about paying $10, $12, $15 a month for a game, unless that's the only game I'm playing.
Well, what do you get out of it? Like, that's my question.
That's the thing. It makes no sense to charge $15 a month to play Dragon Quest X because it's probably not really matchmaking. It's not running giant servers. It's probably doing peer-to-peer online play anyway. Yeah. And they're not going to be offering like massive updates and patches and rebalancing and stuff like that. They're just, you're not really paying for anything.
Yeah. I mean, if it could be almost like Live, where I buy a year long subscription for one fee, that's not huge. You know, if I were to drop $50 in one shot and say I'm good for a year, I think that proposition's okay with me. But if I'm seeing a credit card hit every month, even if it comes out to $50, it might be harder for me to, you know, accept.
Yeah. I mean, I could see something like maybe like $20 a year, because that to me is like subscribing to like ESPN.com.
But if you do that, what you're essentially doing is asking people to pay $70, $80 for Dragon Quest in America.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
That's a tough sell.
They're going to sell 10,000 copies. It's just it's a losing idea. So this game will be free to play in America, I tell you right now, because there's no other way for them to sell it.
Well, how are they going to make their secondary revenue stream then? Are they going to employ...
In Japan, that's how. Mm-hmm. Look, the amount of money that they're going to make in America is a sliver of this game's budget anyway.
See, I still feel like if that's their philosophy, then what's their reason to bring it out outside of Japan? Because the cost of doing so.
Let me throw this one out there. I mean, you know, are they even necessarily going to bring it out for the Wii outside Japan?
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe they just make it a Wii U launch title.
I could see that because of the delay anyway.
Yeah, and at that point, people are going to buy it because there probably won't be anything else to play.
Yeah, because it's like virtually a launch window title that is a giant RPG for your brand new Wii U console.
Yeah, and it's like, well, gee, maybe I'll try this out, you know?
Yeah, that's a good way. I mean, that's the time to launch or relaunch a franchise is when a system just first comes out.
Especially a game where the idea is to get you hooked on it so you keep playing, because if it's the only game you have to play, then it's it's going to be very easy to get butts in the seats.
And again, the Wii version in Japan comes with a USB thumb drive, you know, in the US.
That's so weird.
Now we're getting into like, I mean, you know, it makes sense because they've got to store a whole lot of data. But now in the U.S., it's like, well, okay, how many USB thumb drives do we have to make? We have to send them out all over the country. Is the game going to cost so much more? You know, in Japan, they'll pay $80 for this, right? They will go out and they will pay $80 because because games cost crazy amounts of money in Japan. It doesn't matter. In the U.S., if you're going to put you really want to put a USB thumb drive into every single box, you know? I mean, the more I think about this, the more I think that, you know, maybe, and then of course you've got to translate the whole thing. By the time you finally translate this whole game, and again, maybe, you know, maybe Nintendo and everybody has been working really, really closely on this, and they're gonna roll it out worldwide all at the same time. But maybe they're gonna have to translate it after it comes out in Japan, and by the time that it's ready to come to the US, you know, maybe the Wii U will have been out for a year. We don't even know. Like, they have not said anything about America yet. Nothing.
Right.
Nobody has ever said this is even coming to America yet. It will. It absolutely will. But it could take a very long time.
Right.
And it might take so long that it simply does not come out on the Wii.
I think that's quite possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and we can presume that the Wii U version will not have this crazy thumbstick thing because, you know, that console should have a lot more storage built into it. Right. It's also probably going to have expandable storage that's much more flexible than the SD card is on Wii. So,
yep.
I do think it's really interesting that this is happening at all on the Wii version because the Wii doesn't have any capability to read memory off a USB thumbstick. So this is going to probably require some kind of firmware update from Nintendo to even make this thing work at all on the Wii.
Oh.
I'm sure that Square Enix is receiving all kinds of special dispensation to do all kinds of things with the Wii and the 3DS and even possibly the Wii U that Nintendo would not let other developers do or would not work with them to that extent to let them do to get this thing running to the extent that they want it to run.
All right, well, that's Dragon Quest. We still don't know a ton about the game itself in terms of, you know, the scope of the story, the characters. The gameplay itself seems to be, it's being developed internally by Square Enix, which is kind of interesting because the last two games were level 5. And I'm not sure how I feel about that because I really like the level 5 games, especially 8. So,
well, they have a new Inazuma game they just announced, so you can go play soccer. It'll be fun.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of indicates to me, like you said, I mean, it's more online than definitely anything has been done previously.
I guess so. I mean, it does look a lot like 8 in terms of the interface, in terms of the graphical style, which I'm very happy about. And to me, the sort of the selling point when I was watching the gameplay video is, you know, you've got your character and he's kind of running around town, he's going in buildings and he's searching through drawers and stuff and he's talking to people, but then he goes through the town gates and he walks out into the world. And you see very briefly, you see the character running around the world and sort of exploring it, and he sees an enemy and you can actually see the enemy in the world and then you walk up to it and fight it. That was my favorite part of Dragon Quest VIII. I've discussed it many times on the show, and that appears to be intact with 10. And that alone is, you know, that's why I want to play it. That's why I want to play Xenoblade, because I like exploring these worlds. I like seeing the art, and I like getting a sense of how this world is put together and how it's designed, and finding interesting things to visit and check out. So
yeah, I think that they can make this feel like Dragon Quest, but increase the amount of communication, you know, by linking you up with other players.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that this is going to be like, oh, hello, that shirt, I gave it to Bob. Go ask Bob for it. He's in the mines. Trek, 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 trek. Oh, hey, yeah. No, I'll totally give it to you if you kill 10 spiders. Kill, 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 kill.
I hate spiders.
You know, like, I somehow doubt that it's going to go that far.
Right.
I don't think they're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater on this, certainly from what I've seen. It could turn out to be like a massive faceplant, like the last MMO they made. But, you know, we will certainly see what happens. It's going to be a very, very, very interesting year.
Yeah, and the last thing we should probably mention here is that I don't think we have any information yet about the communication options.
USB keyboard.
USB keyboard?
It will support one.
Yep, they did say that.
Is that all?
You know what you're probably going to be able to do? If you're going to use your Wiimote, maybe you'll be able to bring up an on-screen virtual keyboard, which is a kludge,
yeah,
but at least it's better than, like, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using a classic controller pro, maybe they'll figure you'll buy a USB keyboard if you want to get into it, or maybe it'll just be, like, you know, gestures and set phrases and things like that.
Yeah, PSO.
If you want to communicate with people, you either need a keyboard, or you need an on-screen virtual keyboard, or you do it all through your controller.
Or it's backwards compatible with the ASCII keyboard controller for GameCube.
Or on a Wii, you use Skype.
There you go.
Skype is the real answer here, but I'm going to be curious if they even attempt to support the Wii Speak or Headbanger. I think it's the kind of thing that they could.
They're not supporting the Headbanger, in part because it's called the Headbanger.
They could. And I think it could be a similar case to Monster Hunter. It didn't have voice chat in Japan. When they brought it to America, they said, look, this is an online game. There's no way we're going to get anyone in America to play it if it doesn't have voice chat. So they added Wii Speak support to it. And I think that kind of thing could happen again.
I would rather not even have voice chat than use Wii Speak. It's just that bad. It's terrible. It's actually annoying. It really makes your game experience worse using it. Because you have to sit there and figure out what somebody's saying. You can't understand what people are saying at the time. You have to yell into it. Somebody else walks into the room and asks you if you want a drink and shut up, I'm trying to talk to somebody. It's just terrible, man. It's just terrible.
Well, I do think with Wii U, at least, I think Wii U will probably support some kind of headset to plug in the controller, but I also think...
Well, it's got a microphone on the controller,
that's what I was going to say. I think the controller itself actually has its own microphone and its own speaker, so it's almost like you have your own personal Wii Speak in your lap. So it also does that, which will probably work better than the USB version that they've got out for Wii, but still.
The U-Speak.
I hope there's a headset option, at least. Okay, well, the Tokyo Game Show is coming up in a couple of weeks, less than a couple of weeks, and Chris is going to be there, our friend Billy's going to be there, the Famicast crew will be there, so we've got a lot of friends and co-workers.
Some enemies.
So, yes, I don't have any enemies, come on. Except Tim Rogers. But he'll probably be there too. And Tokyo Game Show is a big deal for Japanese games. It's where, traditionally, actually, for the past several years, there have been a lot of DS games shown there, not as many Wii games. But DS has always had a big presence there. And I think the big question for this year's show, and it's really up in the air right now, is whether 3DS is going to have not just a big presence, but a good presence at TGS. I mean, I think there's no question there will be some quantity of games shown, but will there be any games that actually look like they're going to sell systems that look like they're going to have a kind of worldwide appeal, that look like they might catch on in Japan? Because, you know, some of the stuff that has been announced is really kind of shovelware. So you're always going to get that at TGS.
Okay. So let's, I think while we're doing this, I'll pull up the Tokyo Game Show floor plan so we can see the, like, five companies that are actually showing.
Yeah, it's kind of sad.
Yeah. Well, Level 5, of course, is having its own separate event, breakout event, and we know some of the games they have for 3DS. They'll probably have a couple surprises there, just like they did last year or so.
But they're allowed to do whatever they want at this point.
They can have their own event. I mean, I'm pretty sure. Okay, look. Tokyo Game Show, and this is me being an outside person who kind of knows a little bit about the world but doesn't specifically know a whole lot about the business workings of Tokyo Game Show. They've probably got a very, very lengthy contract with the Makuhari Messe. This is, they have to have it there every single year, and they've rented out the entire thing, you know, every single year, and they don't need all this floor space anymore, you know? And no. I wouldn't be too surprised if the rent on people is kind of going up, you know what I mean? And so if you're level five, you're thinking, well, geez, we're paying so much for our Tokyo Game Show booth. Why don't we might as well just have our own show.
Yeah.
So Tecmo Koei has a booth, Square Enix has a booth, and we know that they're going to have Kingdom Hearts for 3DS is going to be there.
And Slime Mori Mori.
Probably that crazy music game might be there too, right?
Yeah, Final Fantasy Theatrhythm.
The Theatrhythm.
And that game that's being developed by Nspace. So actually, Square Enix will probably have a pretty substantial.
Oh, the Heroes or whatever.
Heroes of Ruin.
We've got the entire middle of the main hall is filled with mobile and social games. There's a huge mobile and social game area with a bunch of little booths for smaller companies, and there's a massive, massive booth for Gree, which is the big social game maker. So let's forget about that. I'll probably be writing a big article on social games because that's clearly the story this year.
Sony
has a massive booth. I doubt they're going to have any 3DS games. Sega has a...
There's your announcement.
Yeah. Scoop. Sega has a pretty huge booth.
They've got three 3DS games.
Oh, they do? What games?
Sonic Generations, Rhythm Thief, and Shinobi.
Rhythm Thief is interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Like, it looks like a cross between Elite Meat Agents and Professor Layton?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I bet Sega will have other announcements as well. Because they are a pretty big publisher.
That's the list we have of their stuff at the moment.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Let's put it that way.
And that's probably about it. Like, probably not going to be any huge surprises on the show floor. And Namco Bandai Games has a big booth, but the games won't be any good, so who cares? And then finally, Capcom has a massive one. And a lot of that's probably going to be devoted to Monster Hunter on 3DS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be tons of games.
No.
Well, Namco Bandai does have the Tekken game.
Ace Combat, Brave Company, Tekken. Yep. Shin-Chan, Tetris, and then one more.
Yeah, and then you've got Konami, and they've got Metal Gear. They've got a couple other small things.
Love Plus. Love Plus is not a small thing.
Love
Plus is important.
Well, I'm expecting a Castlevania game from Konami. I think the time is ripe for 3DS Castlevania to be announced.
Castlevania Love Plus, maybe?
If we're lucky.
love your vampires.
Symphony of the Love Plus.
I'd buy that. Day one sale.
So, Chris, are you kind of expecting it to be kind of a slow 3DS showing at TGS, or just a slow show period?
Well, if okay, I mean, yeah, certainly a slow show. Period. Probably I feel like the big thing for people, you know, Dragon Quest X is not playable, obviously. So I'm guessing the big draw is going to be Capcom's booth, and everybody's going to play Monster Hunter, and then probably with people going to Sony's booth to play the Vita, which it's, you know, it's not going to be very long before the Vita is out, so it's going to be. Right. So that's going to be a big draw too. But yeah, I mean, it's, geez, if you look at this floor map, it's just, you know, there's all these little tiny, 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 but Turtle Beach is showing. Turtle Beach.
Headphone sets all over again.
The Behemoth's booth is almost as big as the Arc System Works booth.
Wow.
Well, Arc Systems Works just has a bunch of, like, 3D tennis and 3D bowling stuff.
Oh, yeah, true. But still, like...
Arc-style solitaire. Great.
But really, though, Turtle Beach.
I know.
Wizards of the Coast, LLC. Yeah, massive.
Wizards of the Coast has to show the new version of the Pokemon card game.
This really does show you where the Japanese industry is heading, though. I mean, you know, the traditional games are losing steam, and social and mobile are picking up steam.
So if that's the main conflict of TGS, though, there has to be a subplot of 3DS versus Vita, because this is the first public show of the Vita. Other than PAX, there was some Vita stuff at PAX, but certainly in Japan, it's the first time the Vita is really playable to the public, and it, like you said, it's coming out just before the end of the year in Japan.
Yep.
And this will be the first chance for us to see a lot of third-party stuff for Vita, I think. It's been mostly Sony first-party announcements so far.
Yeah, mostly. There were a few third-party things at E3,
yeah, like, but... Luminous got announced yesterday.
Yeah, right. Monster Hunter's already been announced, of course, but... Do you think that, is there going to be kind of a perceived struggle between 3DS and Vita? I mean, do you think one is going to really dominate the other in terms of the number and quality of games that are going to be shown here?
Well, you know, this is, the Tokyo Game Show is the anti-Nintendo show, right? I mean, it's the answer to Space World for all the games that aren't Nintendo games. So, of course, Sony always dominates Tokyo Game Show. You know, there was that one year where, like, Wii and DS were doing so well that, like, most everything on the floor was Wii and DS, but, like, you know, that's certainly no longer the case anymore. You don't really have that level of crazy dominance. But it is interesting that we're looking at Square Enix's booth and there's not a single Vita game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know in terms of Vita numbers because I don't have the document. One of our Japan correspondents who's registered to be there generated this list from stuff he's been sent, but... According to the Tokyo Game Show organizers, there's 48 3DS games, which seems like a lot, but if you think about it...
It's a hell of a lot more than we had at E3.
That actually is a lot. To be fair, I think that's a lot.
Depends what they are, too. There's probably about 15 Mahjong games in there.
Well, four of them are Arc Systems games, so...
Okay. there's not that many...
So there's 44 games there, really.
Yeah, there's not that many games, usually, that are really even shown at Tokyo Game Show, you know, if you just count the stuff from the really big publisher. So... 48's a good amount, actually. You know, yeah. I think that's pretty healthy for a show that's not about Nintendo in any way, that does not have Nintendo's participation.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wii is limited to things like Champion, Jockey, Gallop and Racer, GI Jockey.
Yeah, imagine how many 3DS games would have been at E3 if Nintendo had not been at E3.
None.
Yeah, right,
no,
yeah.
That's not true. We would have gotten to play Metal Gear Solid somewhere else.
There were three or four at Sega's booth.
Square Enix had the N-Space game.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, so it definitely sounds better than E3.
Oh, and Frogger.
Frogger
Acid Trip Edition, yes. That also existed somewhere.
Yeah, so in that sense, and how many did our Japan correspondent calculate how many Vita games were?
He didn't list them because he wrote the article for us.
I bet it's less than 48, but...
So he doesn't know 48 games. They just released a number plus games that they were willing to discuss, or games that companies had announced, essentially.
Okay, so it's not like all 48 have names attached to them. They're just...
Right, so like all that was listed for Capcom was Resident Evil Revelations. Well, we know Monster Hunter 3G is going to
be... Yeah, and I'm hoping there's more beyond even those two. I mean, Capcom's a huge publisher in Japan, so...
Yeah, presumably they have other things.
I would not be surprised if there was a new Street Fighter or possibly a portable version of Marvel vs. Capcom 3, because Street Fighter 4 3D did very, very well as a launch title.
Yeah, there was a competition thing too, obviously.
Yeah, but they've established that they can make a really good fighting game on 3DS and that there seems to be some kind of market for it. So I would expect there to be a new fighting game shown for 3DS, and that'll be good.
And they've got Tekken will be there, so obviously they're not the only ones who think they can make this work.
No, I mean, that there are now 5 or 6 fighting games on the 3DS once Tekken comes out. Mm-hmm. So there is a market that is being served heavily.
So I've said that Nintendo doesn't show at Tokyo Game Show. It's not a Nintendo show, but at the same time, they are crashing the party, as we've mentioned already.
Yeah.
They will be hosting their own event the Tuesday before Tokyo Game Show, so getting out in front of everybody's press conferences and everything. And I do not believe that it is the show where they show off this second circle pad and all the games are for that. I think that that's certainly part of it, but they wouldn't do something this big if there weren't like major announcements, and those announcements really would be revolving around the Nintendo 3DS and just really trying to gin up support and illustrate going into Tokyo Game Show to a lot of people who are going to be writing stories about Tokyo Game Show that don't count Nintendo out just yet.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what they announce there, because their first party lineup is fairly well fleshed out for the next year or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly up through E3, which is the
next. Well, they're not showing in their first-party lineup what it is they're... I mean, Nintendo brilliantly expanded the audience for games with DS by bringing out a whole volley of all kinds of different experimental titles that attracted new and different people to the system. And I really don't know why that their 3DS lineup right now looks like the GameCube's lineup.
Mm-hmm.
Except for possibly the fact that they became very strangely complacent and didn't think that it was necessary to do this anymore.
I mean, is it possible they think that those games have moved on to a cell phone platform where they cost $3 versus, you know, Dr. Kawashima's brain training, which was 20?
Well, I mean, if you asked this to Miyamoto in a press conference, he'd probably tell you, well, we put the Street Pass Mii Plaza in there, so that's casual. And
oh yeah,
and we had Nintendogs as a launch game, so
that's exactly what I asked him, you know, at the round table, and he was like, yeah, well, you know, we have Nintendogs day one. And it's like, yeah, but that's
because we laughed about the answer. Yes.
Yeah, it's like, well, that's one game for one group of people.
Well, technically it's 3 games, but
yeah,
still.
No, it's not. It's 3 games. It's technically one game.
And it's not like it's not as if Nintendogs is like as fresh and new now as it was when it came out for the DS. It's a 5-year-old game.
Yeah,
so
that really hasn't changed that much conceptually.
They added cats. That is what changed.
I think it's great. I think it's important for them to have it there. I think it was a good idea to get it out there at launch. But it's not about Nintendogs. It's about new and interesting ways of play. And they're, for some very strange reason, not really moving forward with much of anything like that on 3DS. And so I'm kind of hoping that, like, they'll announce a bunch of cool games. And I think, you know, they said that they were expecting third parties to pick up more of the slack. I don't think that they were ever going to do that. I think that the third parties, for all that they complain that they get crowded out by Nintendo games, they're so skittish when they don't have Nintendo games to show them what kind of games to make.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the DS lifespan, really, early on in the DS, third parties weren't super heavily leveraged on it.
Yeah.
That came after that upswing. You saw companies
it's awfully tough to expect third parties or claim that you're expecting third parties to help with an unproven platform.
But isn't that what happens with every platform launch? I mean, doesn't every platform launch require third parties make a leap of faith?
It does, but it also requires that the first party sort of establish what the system can do and establish, you know, a few different kinds of games that can be done with the new technology. And Nintendo has not done a good job of it with the DS. They didn't do a good job of it with the first DS. If you remember, the launch, especially in America, was for DS in 2004, was heavily leveraged on third-party stuff.
Yeah.
And it didn't sell very well, and it didn't move a whole lot of units. And 6 months later, Nintendo was forced to kind of start announcing a ton of games because the third parties had not picked up the slack like they thought it would.
Well, the thing is, too, it also takes third parties, a certain amount of time to come to grips with the hardware, and not all third parties will get it way in advance.
Yeah.
Like any piece of hardware. I mean, Nintendo might give hardware well in advance to, say, Capcom, Square Enix, or those huge third parties.
Ubisoft.
But I mean, other third parties, they're left out in the cold, and so they'll probably get it pretty much around launch. So they'll have, like, a year out before they start bringing out games for it.
It is really the responsibility of the platform maker to come up with the fancy new ideas, because third parties are not going to take that risk. They are going to look, especially these days, especially when a game costs $40 to buy and everybody has a phone that lets them buy games for a dollar. Third parties are only going to look at games that that have some kind of mitigation of the amount of risk that they're taking in terms of making them.
Mm-hmm.
So the third parties, even if they have some great idea that could be the next Brain Age, they're not going to make it. It's Nintendo that must take that risk because nobody else is going to do it. And it's just funny that they're not bringing out this... It's like Ocarina of Time, Star Fox... The Nintendo DS did not sell off the back of space shooters and Zelda. Those were some of the lowest selling games on the Nintendo DS. The highest selling games were things that were just were far Brain Age, which was just made fun of, you know. And so it's like where are these games? Like where are these new ideas that not very long ago, it's not like the executives all quit and it's new guys in there and everything they do. It's the same guys, you know? It's just Iwata and Miyamoto. It's like they had it for a second, and I'm not sure what happened, what's so different about 3DS that caused them to lose sight of that. You know, maybe they're sitting on all of them. Maybe they just got so complacent that they didn't think it was necessary to introduce them until later. I think they thought the 3DS was going to sell like gangbusters, and I think that they were wrong. And so now I think you see Nintendo in not crisis mode, but you see them realizing that there is a fundamental flaw that needs to be addressed. And so hopefully what we're going to see is going to energize, you know, analysts and reporters kind of coming out thinking that Nintendo is getting their act together.
Well, I think in terms of timing, I don't think that they figured that Wii sales would just completely fall off a cliff. And at that point, they said, holy crap, we don't really have anything to follow up with, at least for a while. We don't have the Wii U coming out for a while. We have to get something out there.
And I think it's very important that instead of being like Sony with the PSP or the PS3, and you know, they just took super drastic measures and they're taking a loss, you know, I think on the making of the console to do it, because they realize that it's a sprint, not a marathon. Everybody, whoever's in last place always likes to tell you that it's a marathon, not a sprint, and that they'll catch up. But by the time that they catch up, it's irrelevant because the next run of consoles are coming along, you know? They realize that you get out in front big, fast, and that success breeds success. They want to sell as many of these things as they possibly can before Sony gets the Vita out in the market, because the last thing they want is for Sony to start selling. They never, ever, ever want Sony to catch up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even with the Xbox 360 doing as well as it is right now off the back of Kinect and price drops and redesigns and all the other things that they did, it is never going to catch the Wii. The worldwide gap is, like, tremendous. It's never, ever, ever going to happen. And that's what they want to do with 3DS. They always want to get, you know, perception is reality. They always want to be able to say, we're the absolute bestseller.
Okay, well, that's our TGS preview. It's too bad Chris didn't talk more, but we'll have him on another time, and that's gonna wrap up the show. So we'll get a couple plugs in here. Radio Trivia Podcast Edition every couple of weeks. That's an awesome show that you should listen to. You can also check us out on facebook.com/radiofreenintendo, and we've got Twitter. what are our names on Twitter? I'm at Johnny Metz. Chris?
I'm at Kobun Heat, which I guess I should probably change to my real name at some point because it's always very confusing, but it's Kobun Heat. But if you go to Game Life, it's linked off of all my articles, so it's very easy.
There you go.
I'm NWR_Lindy.
Yeah, and it says I'm NWR_James. Because I beat the other two James to the punch.
Yeah. Are you really? I didn't know you had your own account now. I'm going to have to add you.
I've had one for a long time, but it was just to follow other news stories. And I finally started tweeting my disgust at Devil Saga.
Okay.
that was the catalyst, was my utter disgust with that game.
If you want more drips of acid from the mouth of James Jones, you should follow him at NWR_James. I know I will. So do all of that stuff and review us on iTunes. And Chris Kohler, thank you very, very much for being our guest once again. And why don't you plug a couple of things?
Yeah, sure. if you enjoyed me yelling into your ear holes, you can hear much the same thing except for in written format. If you go to wired.com, and once you're there, click on the games section or just go to wired.com/gamelife, where I and a crew of very talented writers weigh in all the time on all kinds of different things. You can have someone yell the article at you if you want. You know, you can actually just have someone sit in your computer and just say it in a very loud, insistent voice. And it's kind of like talking to me.
Yeah, you could probably find a really loud text-to-speech converter as well.
I text-to-speech Game Life at work, so we're good to go.
There you go.
Yeah,
and by the way, Chris mentioned it earlier, but everyone should go read his excellent tête-à-tête with John Mixmeyer about Dragon Quest X.
It was actually with Jason Schreier.
Oh, fuck.
Damn. Yeah, sorry.
Plug fail.
Written while John Mixmeyer was actually having major surgery. So he I don't even think he knows about Dragon... No, I'm sorry. Excuse me. He does know about Dragon Quest X. Actually, this is great. By the time you listen to this, he'll have found out. But at this moment, he does not know about the fucking circle pad thing. So I'm going to try to convince him when he gets out of sedation that it doesn't exist. That it's an after effect of the anesthesia.
Nice.
That he's got some kind of weird double vision. So we'll see how that goes. And since you invited me to before the show, I want to make sure that everybody knows it's coming up very soon. Umlaud, which is our San Francisco Child's Play event, in which we take over DNA Lounge, one of San Francisco's best music venues. We give people the chance to play Rock Band 3 up on stage, any one of the 3,000 songs that you want, and you are patched through to an incredible professional sound system, professional lighting guy. We'll be making you look good. You can dress. People have dressed in costumes and done skits, and even if you don't want to do Rock Band up on stage, and I understand there are people who don't, you can come and we have an incredible like silent auction and a raffle and basically all of the video game swag that I can collect over the course of a year. We raffle and auction it off. And we take all the money and we give it all to Child's Play. It's a really good time. So umlaud.com, that's UMLOUD, like an umlaut, but loud. Please check us out. And if you're in the Bay Area, consider once we start selling band packages and selling time up there on stage, consider doing that.
Yeah, it's an awesome event. I would love to attend sometime.
Fly in your fucking rocket ship to San Francisco.
It's not finished. I'm still working on it. All right. Thanks again, Chris. We'll be back next week with Greg and the whole crew. So we'll see you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
They're not so hard that you need to justify like a $30 purchase anymore. Like it's just $4. Like let me blow through it and move on to the next weekly black and white video game.
Mm-hmm. Right. If they, assuming they actually release one that's even moderately worth playing.
Cat Trap is not. I'll tell you that right now. Cat Trap or Cat Rape or whatever it's called.
Cat Rape.
I like to think it's Cat Rap. And
Cat Rap?
It's actually it's the Paula Abdul's friend.
That was Scat Cat, MC Scat Cat.
Yeah, MC Scat Cat.
Yep.
Yeah. Scat Cat Rap. Scat Rap.
Yeah, he was scatting, though, not rapping. Oh, no, wait. I don't know.
And when you say scatting, you, of course, mean the game Scat.
Game Scat.
I own as many Wii Speaks as I own games that support it, so think about that next time we want to put it into a game.
But Miyamoto told me that everybody has the WeSpeak channel, so we can just use that. We don't need games.
The WeSpeak channel is a work of a madman.
It's so much fun. You don't need a game. You just turn on the WeSpeak channel and...
you don't. It's better than any game that supports it.
That was one of the most amazing spin moves I've ever seen in a press conference. Was a couple E3s ago. We were at the round table, and I asked Miyamoto. I said, where are the games that support WeSpeak? Can we do it in... Actually, the way I phrase it is New Super Mario Brothers Wii going to support WeSpeak? Which was kind of two questions in one, because I was like, is it going to have online play? And if it does, can we use WeSpeak? Because right. I said, like, WeSpeak's been out for a year, and there's like two games for it. And Miyamoto literally told me, well, even though there may not be many games, we gave everybody the WeSpeak channel, so you could just use that. Wow.
It's like, look at this shiny thing over here.
Oh, look at distraction. Run out of the room.